Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John McMurtry. John has been on many times. Regular listeners know John very well, and I get marvelous feedback from some of them saying they really enjoy the program when John comes on. His comments are always so incisive. We're going to talk about three topics in the program. We'll split the program roughly in about the three 20-minute segments. Let me just mention one thing before I tell you what the topics are. Virtually every day I write two new articles. I post them the next day on my blog site, Steve Lindman Blog. Anybody can follow my writing by going to my blog site. You can see it has every article I've written from the very first one to the latest that went up this morning to the newest ones that will go up tomorrow morning. And I'll tell you what the newest ones will be about tomorrow. On February 11th, Iran will commemorate the 35th anniversary of its 1979 revolution. I'll discuss it in my article. I'll give you the timeline of events. I'll put in a lot of my own comments. I'll quote other comments by people who deserve to be heard. It'll be there on, it'll go up tomorrow morning, and Tuesday is the 35th anniversary. Festivities have been ongoing since the 1st of February, but it's in my article. Readers can access it. And the other article I write about, it's a topic I've addressed in various ways in other articles. I call it low-wage America. Indeed so. Race to the bottom, impoverishing people, just a desperate situation, rotten jobs, lousy pay, terrible working conditions, the state of working America today. It's all in my article. You can access that one tomorrow. No punches pulled. Here's what we'll talk about today. We'll start off talking about the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Well, I've given those talks various names, sham talks, no peace, peace talks. We'll get into that. We'll also talk about the deplorable farm bill that really hands out benefits lavishly to big agriculture and takes them away from starving Americans, literally taking food out of the stomachs of hungry children. We'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about, we'll go back, we talked about it briefly, I think it was last weekend, about the Super Bowl. Oh, not the teams, not who won, not who lost. We'll talk about the other issues that never get reported in sports programs. So we'll go into that. John, welcome. Let's begin talking about the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. I've got so much to say. Let me let you begin, and I'll chime in.
Well, I just wanted to remind your listeners that your blog is really excellent. I mean, you have a flow of facts that you are not going to find elsewhere on Steve's blog, so I just emphasize that it is available and it comes out so regularly that really any issue you want to find the facts on, that's probably the best place you can go. Now, the Israel-Palestine, you wonder whether it's just show negotiations all over again. And I'm going to go back to the what I've mentioned before, is that Israel is almost, I mean, this is a very ancient, it's the central story of humanity in a way, Israel's story. And I think that's the sort of the subtext meaning of the chosen people. But what has never, ever said on the mass media or by state leaders, I mean, we've recently had Stephen Harper, our, I would say, neo-fascist leader in Canada, very unprecedented. He says he went to Israel. He's now pronounced Israel's greatest friend. And he said that criticism of Israel and the boycotts that are building of Israel are the new face of anti-Semitism. And so this anti-Semitism argument has been used to stop any criticism whatever of Israel. And what is not understood is that the greatest irony of all is that Israel has been the most mass murderously genocidal anti-Semitic nation in, except for the Nazis, in history. It goes way back to the beginning. It's a terror state from the beginning. And I want to say at the same time that Israel or the people from the Jewish culture are leading people. So I think one of the reasons when I said it's center of the human condition is you have good and evil really posed against each other in a very dramatic profile. And it goes back to the beginning, the bad side. Now, the beginning also has the prophets, and the beginning also has so much wonderful things. But what we find in the very beginning from the Jewish Bible itself is that their tribal God tells them, and I'm going to quote it, and what I'm quoting right now is Genesis 17:21, to take the whole land of Canaan for Israel to own in perpetuity. Unquote. And then an explicit prohibition of any pact with them, and the word pact is used as, you know, that is denounced. You're not to make any pact with them, and this is the tribal God's command. You are to exterminate all of, as we now know it, Palestine's inhabitants. Exterminate them all. Now, they're all Semitic people, the Amorites. The Hittites, this is in Exodus 23:24. The Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. All of them, exterminate them. And it goes on clear, women and children, everything. So we have a terror state from the beginning. And this is never, I don't know anybody else who's ever brought this out in publication. This fact, this very bald, basic fact. And so what we have going on now is claims of anti-Semitism, when we have the most anti-Semitic nation except the Nazis, killing all those, murdering, genociding all, a genocidal nation, and now and a terrorist nation. Well, you may say, well, those are words, but we always hear anti-terrorism coming from there. Always talking about the terrorists, the terrorists, the terrorists. The litany of broken international law and terrorist acts by the state of Israel stems right back to that tradition, which is pretty well anything has happened. I mean, we have a clearance of subsistence people happening across the world. That's part of the cancer stage of capitalism and the Israel-Palestine confrontation is as well. But we have very specific things going on here of just non-stop breaking of international laws and criminal laws, and it's never mentioned. You never hear the crimes mentioned. They'll never be mentioned. They'll never even say it's against international law, for example, all the settlements. But it isn't just the settlements, which are against international law. In fact, they're a crime against humanity. And it's, you know, then to take the land and build on it and then to claim sovereignty over it, all of this is just criminal violations of international law. In fact, it really amounts to a kind of ethnic cleansing. In fact, there's an argument that it's genocidal in accordance with United Nations law. And it's an apartheid system too. It's interesting to know that Israel, again, a fact that's never mentioned, Israel and South Africa during the apartheid period of South Africa were the closest of friends. They always voted with each other, but not only that, it was on the ground. The South Africans were selling them, and Israel was selling the South Africans weapons, and the South Africans was bringing their people, the so-called counter-terrorist units. You remember, they always say terrorists for the opposition. The Nazis use the word terrorist anybody who opposed them.
John, so, let me mention
the South Africans.
John,
lent them
assistance. John, let me interrupt, please.
Sorry.
Let me make a couple of comments. My listeners know that I'm Jewish. I don't hide it. I'm what's called a self-hating Jew, which is about as oxymoronic as you can get. And you have to make a distinction between Jewishness and Israeli policy. On the one hand, you're talking about the policies of a state, an entity. And on the other hand, you're talking about a religion and the fact that Israel can call itself a Jewish state. Well, that alone to me is a crime against humanity, especially with one-fifth of its population, over one-fifth, being non-Jews, but I separate the two entirely, and yet I'm vilified by some people for going against the principles of my faith, which I am not. I support the rule of law, and any country that does not support the rule of law and breaks the law is a criminal state, and Israel most certainly is a criminal. criminal state?
Well, I mean, on the apartheid, you know, their camps, the, you know, which is always denied that apartheid was, is anything. They were in collaboration with the South African and imposing apartheid in South Africa and in Israel with actually their methods of torture and so forth. They were joined at the hip. And so all the things that went on there, you know, torture, imprisonment without charges, land confiscation, you know, isolation. In fact, the isolation that Israel has done, the state of Israel, but the fact that it calls it a religious state, you know, a Jewish state, makes it as a, you know, it makes it, ties it back into the religion. And in any case, the apartheid that's practiced there is more, I've traveled throughout South Africa during the apartheid period, and the isolation of the blacks was not nearly so horrific as the isolation of the Palestinians behind that illegal, again, an illegal and a criminal wall that has been built up and taken even more of their land. And what are they doing at this very moment under negotiations? Taking more land still. And then, you know, all the while they're disrupting their medical care, they're destroying public and private property, again a war crime, and crimes against humanity are non-stop. And what's interesting, I mean, the whole religion thing to me is a kind of a red herring, because the people who are leading it, like Netanyahu and the press, they seemed pretty secular, actually. They were more, I think, in the fascist mold, and that's the other great irony, is that we have the behavior of the Nazis themselves, not the death camps, but in other respects, the behavior of the, and claims of the Nazis themselves to Lebensraum, that they were going to take other people's land for their room and that they had to have it, and now they're saying anybody wants to stop the settlements, which is a crime under international law, is anti-Semitic and wanting to stop the housing of people and children. I mean, it just, there's no real limit to it. The Nazis claim the same thing, and that the great irony is that they have behaved, they're behaving like, and it's not even really the state of Israel, it's the Likud party there, a Likud party that's really at the core of it. And we might, instead of saying Israel, say the Likud party, because there's lots of people, as we know, who are as opposed to what's going on in Israel, who are Jewish themselves and away from Israel, as we are. That we have this huge irony that the Holocaust that we all are to respect and revere the memory of, and I agree with that, is being imposed themselves, or has been imposed in the past, by the Jews. I mean, they have eliminated, they have genocided the Palestinian people since 1948, and that goes way back to prehistory and the original Bible, which is still cited as the holy book.
John, I must point out one thing. I agree with the fact that Likud is the most extreme party, but the current Israeli Knesset is its most extremist in the country's history, and the so-called Labor Party, that was a legitimate opposition at one point, is so weak-kneed that the great majority of the Knesset members, I believe 120, I think that's the number, I hope that's right, it's pretty close, that I don't think you'll find more than a handful of legitimate representatives in that parliamentary body that really represents the interests of adhering to the rule of law. It really is a fascist government. You nail that absolutely, John. Netanyahu is a public face.
Yeah, you're right.
But
you're right,
not
that it
the
goes
only
beyond
one.
The Likud party, but they're the leader of it and they're the source of it. So, but I take your, you know, that it's, we're dealing with a pathology that has been institutionalized beyond that party. Yes,
it has
I agree.
A coalition it's number one partner, John. It's called Israel is Our Home. That's the translation of the party, and they're every bit as extremist as Likud.
Oh yeah, I'm sure they're marked.
Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister, is in that party, and you've got you got some other raging extremists. The policies of these people,
John. Out and out fascists. Yeah.
Oh, they're fascists. They're absolutely fascists. And the idea, we've had peace talks on and off going on for the last 35, 40 years. They've gone absolutely nowhere because Israel demands everything. It gives nothing in return. And that's exactly what's going on now. So as you pointed out, John, during talks that began last July, and now we're into getting near the middle of February almost, literally, Israel is building more settlements. They're bulldozing Palestinian homes. homes. They're stealing Palestinian lands. Every single day, John, I wonder if listeners know this. I've written about it a number of times.
Trees. Yeah.
Every single day, multiple times every day, 7 days a week, every day of the year, there are incursions into civilian Palestinian communities in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem. There are multiple arrests made. Children are arrested. People are roughed up. Households are ransacked. Property is destroyed. It's stolen. And I say literally, the last time I mentioned this, it was something like 70-odd incursions in a seven-day period. So we're talking, what, an average of 10 a day? Into communities. These are innocent civilians. They committed no crimes. And just imagine living in a community where you simply don't know, pre-dawn or maybe sometime after midnight, troops are going to break in your front door and absolutely terrorize you. And this is what Palestinians live through every day. It's ongoing during the peace talks. And one more thing, John, and I'll let you get back in. The people representing Palestine in these talks, a longtime Israeli collaborators. They negotiated Oslo. There was a giveaway. It was Palestine's Versailles. And now you can call what's going on this time Oslo 2.0.
A terrorist state. And you notice the reverse projection operation again, as always, that the biggest terrorist state are always projecting it on to who they want to commit terror against as the terrorists, as the reason for attacking them. And so we never hear that word of a rogue state or a terrorist state. Well, all the examples you gave, which are all documentable, you know, over 50% of people have been criminally assaulted in, you know, when they've done polls, just how many people have been, as you say, where crimes have been committed against them in terms of assault and theft and, of course, murder. Over 50% have experienced that directly. So this is a terrorist state beyond terrorist states. It's more terrorist, really, than certainly anything that we've seen. I'm just thinking in my mind with South Africa. What's really more terrorist than South Africa itself, in terms of all the incidents that are going on? It's never called a terrorist state, though. It's always said we must stop the terrorists. Always, and nobody ever takes them up on it. Now, I'm wondering, when I hear Kerry saying, and I know you don't think, you just think he's, you know, it's the usual rhetoric without any meaning, but he recently said, today's status quo, absolutely, to a certainty, I promise you, 100%, cannot be maintained. That's pretty strong talk. I've never heard that talk before. And so they must be aware of what we're aware of to some extent, because although there's a big division between Jews, the rich tend to be for what the Israel state's going, and the people who are more, you know, who are learned are against it. That Kerry is resolved to do something here. I've never seen language that strong, 100, that if you're going to continue like this, and of course you have on the other side Harper saying anybody who's against it is anti-Semitic, it's the new face of anti-Semitism, that he's saying that it's 100%, I'm guaranteeing you, I promise you, that this is not sustainable, we're not going to go along with it. So that is a possible hope, because knowledge always wins, Steve. It may take hundreds of years, but knowledge always wins. And the knowledge here that we have been expressing here on this program is overwhelming. It's overwhelmingly documented. And it's overwhelmingly in motion as we speak. I mean, the International Court of Justice voted 14-1 against, you know, saying that it was a criminal, that wall is a criminal act. And the knowledge has got to get out. And, of course, what we have is a mass media system in which none of these things are ever allowed to be said. And that's the thing that's holding back the onrush of sort of actual events happening. Because once the knowledge is in, it wins. It wins in the end. It's just how many people are going to be abused, terrorized, killed, their lives ruined before this. This is the longest standing fascist occupation in modern history.
Yeah, it really is, John. And I forget the actual statistic. I've used it in articles, but it's been a good while. Something like a third or maybe even up to half of Palestinian youths, male youths or adults, have spent time in Israeli prisons.
Yeah.
And they've committed no crimes. They're political prisoners. Oh, I'm certain there are a few criminals in there somewhere. But basically,
well,
they've committed no crimes.
They might have fought back with rocks against the rocket launchers.
Well, I mean, Israel calls self-defense terrorism. You know, international law gives everybody the right to self-defense, whether it's an individual, a group, or a nation. And Israel, of course, commits outrageous crimes that are premeditated and planned and so on. The wars that it wages, the same thing. I want to wrap up this segment and move to the next one, but it's a deplorable situation. You could almost compare these talks to something like a nuclear-armed Goliath against a David with no slingshot. I mean, that's the
I'd like to use the language of denunciation of the people who are doing this and responsible for it, that they themselves are the proved terrorist state and the proved terrorists of our time, and they are a rogue state and a terrorist state, and they're genocidal. And all of this is known. All of this is established in international law. That's the one that's their weak point. They have no answer to it. The only answer they've got to it is to make it unspeakable, make it taboo to say. So I think that's the one we should emphasize. This is a terrorist state, but under international law.
John, it certainly is, and I never lose hope, and I must say, in the end, I don't know if I'll live long enough to see it, but I honestly believe, I mean, the courage of Palestinians is really incredible. I mean, they've gone through this since late 1947, when the so-called 48 war, Israel War of Independence began. November, December 47, it began, ended in the middle of May 1948, but since that time, the courage of Palestinians to withstand everything Israel has thrown against them, and here they are, still resilient, still fighting back the best that they can. I mean, they can't compete with Israel militarily, but I honestly think as Israel's reputation gets increasingly besmirched, which is exactly what's happening,
happening. That's where knowledge is going to win. This boycott has got legs.
It's not going
to go away.
I just wrote an article about it. There are lots of things where companies and so on in Europe are simply starting to boycott Israeli companies and institutions. And
once
I think
the knowledge
end,
is out. Yeah.
Oh, well, the knowledge is there. All you have to do is look and find it.
Well, the problem is the mass media won't cover any of it. They will never say that Israel is a war criminal.
It's there in volumes on the internet. I mean, articles are only a smidgen of what's out there that anybody can access and know the truth and get distinguished people presenting documented evidence. It's very, very clear. And in the end, I think the Palestinians will win. I don't know how many more will die and how much more suffering there'll be. Will it be a decade? Will it be two decades? I think Israel will be defeated. I think the Palestinians will be triumphant.
Maybe Israel will be Palestine again. Not so much defeated. Is that it will stand for what Jewishness is supposed to stand for instead of being the greatest betrayal of its possibility in history.
Absolutely, John. Let's move on because sadly we only have an hour. We don't have all afternoon to talk about these things. And I must say, I think we're both the same way. When we get into a topic, we get so into it, we literally want to keep going at it because they're major stuff, and there's so much that you can say about this. But let's go on to the second topic. We'll leave the Super Bowl for last. The Farm Bill. Well, I wrote about the Farm Bill. It's a piece of trash. It's almost 1,000 pages long, which means nobody in Congress that voted for it even read the damn thing. Who would sit down and read a 1,000-page bill? It costs $950 odd billion. It's grossly giving handouts to big agriculture, even though it's largely a food stamp and nutrition bill, about $750 billion to that. But while it's being cut, $8.7 billion on top of $11 billion in food stamps that were cut last November. There were lavish giveaways to big farmers, you know, agribusiness, lavish $90 billion. Instead of calling it subsidies, they changed the language, John.
Well, the insurance company will love it, or the business there.
They call it crop insurance
now. Administration.
I mean, the corporate handouts, giveaways,
yeah.
the same way, you
yeah.
know, bailouts to Wall
10,000
Street.
10,000 beneficiaries get over $100,000 guaranteed a year
yes.
in subsidies. That's pretty good. Some get over $1 million.
Including absentee farmers who never set foot on the land, don't even know
yeah.
where the land is located. They get $100,000 a year.
And meanwhile, they're grinding the poor. That's the thing that, I mean, that's... This is, again, I've got to say, we have an expression of the cancer system at work inside this bill. And the cancer system, which I've talked about before, you know, it's the private transnational money sequences multiply themselves through life host societies and the world and life support, natural life support systems everywhere, merely to multiply themselves. And in doing so, they have to constantly be taking away from life requirements. That's the war. That's the undeclared world war between this money sequence cancer system and life requirements themselves. And what this does is we have a very clear case of the life requirements of 47 million American people underneath this system have not enough to eat. And so we have a New Deal legislation that does give them enough to eat. And so where do they go? Well, almost enough. And where do they go? Mostly families. Where do they go first to cut? Where do they go to take while they're giving $750 trillion a year to the banks free? They go to cut the life needs. That is always predictable from this system. If it isn't doing that, it isn't doing it. And we may have a break away from it. But everywhere that I can see, it's doing it. Take from the life needs of not only the environment, but all of them, and now increasingly the majority of the people without life security, but above all, take from the poor. Robin Hood in reverse, as somebody has described it. Much, much worse than that. It's really grinding them into the dirt in order to have more free money to do what they want to do with it. So it's an expression of this system, a perfect expression of this system. And it's, I mean, what they're doing, I mean, like $20 billion has been taken away since November from the food stamps program. $20 billion. That is nothing to the military, I suppose, which continues to get funded royally, along with more so the banks. But that means that people, families, kids, now have less than $1.40 for a meal. How are you going to get a meal? So they're forced into it the very best, junk food. And the junk food will kill them in the end. I mean, we have more and more multiplying diseases from junk foods, diabetes. A good friend of mine, a black friend of mine, had his legs cut off from diabetes from eating junk food. But it's not just that. Of course, it's a diabetes epidemic. There's heart, you know, it's heart disease, everything. And that's what they're forcing them into, and they call it a farm bill. And then we have Obama saying, what we're doing here is we're reducing our deficits without gutting the vital assistance programs. Those are his words. This is a great gain for America. This is a way we protect, these are exact words from him, protect the most vulnerable Americans. What you see here, which you've been on to for a long time, but what I'm saying is that it's an actual syntax, like a grammar of expression, regulating how the words come out. And the words are always the opposite of fact, and they are big lies concealing always the money sequence cancer system.
Oh, indeed, John.
So for me, it's just one more illustration of it.
John, I've said so many times, Obama says one thing and he does something else.
Well, I think it's built into the very syntax of the time and the order, the disorder, is
indeed.
That you say the opposite of fact as a standard. You know, I was pointing that out with Israel, the reverse projection of terrorism and so forth. That this is actually a syntactical regulator of the speech, and Obama is just a symptom of this.
John, in an article I wrote, it might have been a week, 10 days ago, I went through some of his notorious lies. I don't have it in front of me. I wish I did because it makes good reading. But all the promises he made during his campaigning, mostly the first campaign, but also the second one, you know, and you can keep your doctor, and I'll close Guantanamo, and I'll hold culpable Bush administration
yeah.
officials responsible for their crimes, on and on and on and on. Every one a bald-faced lie.
Yeah. And what it is, and it, you know, this goes, but this is the nature of the cancer system, is always to mask itself in the opposite of what it is and to accuse others of what it's doing itself. That's the logic, the inner logic governing everything it does. And so, what you want to do is control people's perceptions. You never worry about the reality of things. So he's told by his pollsters that those issues that you just mentioned, which were issues that got him elected into power, because he was speaking up on them, that those issues are popular issues. People will support you for them, and I would say because they have an underlying life code, they'll support you for those issues. But that means nothing whatsoever. They're just big lies. That's just part of the operation of this system. It isn't unusual. It doesn't make Obama a big liar. It just makes him a symptom and a creature of a system now that is nothing but lie.
Oh, absolutely, John. I have Stone, the great muckraking journalist who died maybe 25 years ago.
Yeah, I remember him.
His famous quote, he used to lecture to journalists. He used to recommend they paste this quote on their bathroom mirror so they wouldn't forget about it. And the language was a little different. Basically, he said, all governments lie and nothing they say can be believed.
Well, you know, the thing is, it seems, because we both lived since I have Stone has passed away, that it's taken a qualitative turn for the worse.
Oh,
I mean,
indeed.
The lies that he pointed out weren't, I mean, all governments lie, but they don't lie all the time as a matter of the syntactical structure of their speech. And which I'd say is the masking effect of the cancer system. It always has to mask itself to the surrounding life community and life needs, or it can't go well on growing.
John, I don't know
whether you have you noticed this? I mean, it's really kind of startled me because I've been a long time really not wanting to believe it, but everything, absolutely everything that's said is a big lie.
Everything is a big lie. I have Stone, incredibly, in the 1940s, I believe it was, got on Meet the Press. I think that's how far back Meet the Press goes. Maybe it was the early 1950s, but I think it was the late 1940s. And he never was invited back because he said the wrong thing about a topic relating to health care, I believe. But a guy like I have Stone, a really heroic figure, I've read about half a dozen of his books. They're on my shelf. And he was actually invited on Meet the Press. Were somebody like that being invited on today would be an absolute impossibility. I have never once gotten an invitation to go on any of the corporate media. And I must say, John, one time a Fox News radio station in Texas invited me on. I nearly fell over. And then when airtime came, they didn't call me.
I
emailed the host and I said, well, I was holding on for you. Nobody ever called me. And I got the excuse, well, we had some breaking news come up. We couldn't get you on.
Have a stock excuse.
I think somebody took a close look at who I was, and they said, hey, you're not bringing this guy on here. But I was really so eager to get a crack at Fox News, even a local Texas radio station. My one great opportunity went down the drain.
Well, if you got on, you know, they'll take it, because I have been on at least major network things, but with all sorts of consequences. They'll take it out if it's not live, and normally it isn't, it's canned. They'll take it out if you do get something said.
Oh, I called the
Project for a New American Century, I said he was he's liable as a war criminal, and perhaps he should be arrested at the airport for abetting a war crime. They had a half an hour lag at the CBC television when I was doing this debate, three days before the invasion of Iraq, they only had a half hour to do it, but they got it out. They will not allow the truth to be spoken.
Absolutely not. And of course, if you are live with no delay, they can simply interrupt you. They can cut you off and say, we have to go to commercial.
Oh, they'll do it, yeah. Except sometimes you can fight back, but in terms of no, you're not going to silence this. This is very important for people to hear. But then the move is just to make sure you're never on there again.
I once had an email debate with PBS, Public Broadcasting and America TV, about the Lira NewsHour. I complained about their biased reporting, and their ombudsman read my article and emailed me, and I challenged him to invite me on the NewsHour one time. I said, you pick the topic and I'll come on, let my voice be heard. Well, obviously they never invited me, John, and I can't imagine they would ever invite somebody like me on the NewsHour or on CBS,
you know,
or Fox, or any of them.
I will say that we can go. I'm an old grammarian. You can go to it as a grammar of their discourse and their ideology and their mass media presentations. They will never allow anything on that contradicts the basic social structural fact of the society. And the basic social structural fact of our society is, well, you can just say, is money capitalist in production and in profit as the ruling principle. This is, you know, just a neutral description of it before it becomes cancerous. That itself, even though that's neutral and, you know, easy to say inside a textbook, that itself will never be allowed, if it is in any way a critical context, will not be allowed to be said on the mass media. It's ruled out a priori as unspeakable. So you can never call into question the actually ruling system of the society, and this actually is an ancient taboo, but now it has reached such pervasive proportions, and I've studied civilizations across the East and West for over thousands of years. I've never seen it so pervasive as it is today. And so nothing, even though it's a scientific age and an age of knowledge, because once the knowledge out, that, you know, they know that'll make a difference. So they just will never allow out a fact or an argument or an analysis that in any way conflicts with the big lie. Mm-hmm. Except on small details that don't make any difference at the level of the system rule. But anything that challenges the system itself or calls into question even, or even lays it bare as what it in fact is, documentedly is, will be ruled out. And that's exactly what we saw with Israel. That anything that actually states what's true, that Israel is committed war crimes and crimes against humanity under international law and has been judged to have done so and has also violated numerous covenants and conventions of international law, as long as, you know, two pages, but just say any part of that, it'll never be said. They'll always say Israeli settlers, like, this is a good thing, not that this is a war crime. They'll always say Palestinian terrorists or Iranian terrorists, but they'll never, ever say that the Israel government uses terrorist method. In the same way, they will never say that this is gutting the vital assistance program of millions of people. They'll just say the opposite, big lie. And the person who says, well, you know, when people are losing, that are wretchedly poor, are losing $90 a month. I mean, that's like, to lose $90 a month when you're on have almost nothing is literally starving you. That will not allow to be said. It'll only take the form of abstract figures. And if you say this is predictable consequence of this system, that it will always take from life needs and always give to money sequences moving up 90% of its wealth to the rich, it'll never allow that to be understood. And so we have a grammar of delusion, a grammar of big lies that I'm afraid has been so built into this system that not even its diagnosis, medical diagnosis, and scientific proof of it as a cancer system at the social level of life organization will not even be allowed to, as a thought, although everybody will privately agree.
I think part of the strategy
out there as a thought.
part of the strategy also, John, is things are getting increasingly desperate for so many millions of people in America. We're literally, even Obama's proposal for a 10-10 an hour, and it's been misreported in the media, it's for federal contractors. It's not for all public employees. It's not for state and local ones. And for sure, it's not for private sector workers. But 10-10 an hour comes to 40 hours a week times 52 weeks. It's below poverty. It's $21,000 a year. The official federal poverty level for a family of four is grossly understated based on a decades-old guideline. It's $23,500. For anybody to survive in a city like Chicago or Cincinnati or Pittsburgh or any of them, even the smaller cities, you need at least double that amount.
Yeah.
You need $20 an hour.
So you go to junk food and get diseased and die, and that's exactly what the system has programmed you for.
Yes. But I think part of Obama's scheme is you throw a few crumbs at people and you just, you've got a brain tumor, and maybe if you take a stiff dose of medication, you'll ease the pain a little bit, but the tumor won't go away. So the 10-10 an hour is stiff medication, not to solve the problem, but just to make the pain more tolerable. If you want to solve the problem, you got to get rid of the cancer, John. But no,
yeah, we've got to get rid of the cancer. You've got to actually understand what the life requirements are, and that's another thing that never is allowed out there. What is a need? What is the actual life needs that people have? Well, the need is that without which life capacity is reduced. We can objectively determine it in every instance, but we do not find the word need ever used except falsely. We never have any check on anything with respect to their actual need, that is, for their life capacities not to be destroyed. We never have that as a criterion of public judgment, ever. Ever. And so you can always go away and play these games with figures and say, well, we put them up at X percent to such a dollar. So that now they say, when all the, you know, this globalization of the cancer happens, they say, oh, well, 100 million people just got lifted out of poverty in China. What lifted out of poverty comes down to mean is they have, as city slum dwellers, the price of a cup of coffee extra in their income, when they have been taken away from, you know, driven out of the rural subsistence lands and communities and farming into the city, and then they say they're lifted out of poverty for the price of a sugar drink. And they did, and that's reported all over by all the class newspapers and so forth. That's reported as a fact in a headline. Because they never get down to what people's lives actually need. That itself is unspeakable in the cancer system.
Oh, it really is, John. Shall we move on to the next topic?
Yes.
Oh, indeed. Well, you played some football years ago. I must say, let me just mention one thing. I remember as a boy, I must have been around 15 years old, my father on Sundays, not every Sunday, but occasionally, before television, this was in the 1940s, there was a pickup. I don't know if they were semi-pros or a pickup game or whatever, but a couple of miles from where we lived, there was a football game every Sunday, and you could literally stand on the sidelines and watch these guys play. You could see the violence close up and personal. I'm a little guy. Of course, when I was 15 years old, I was smaller than I am now. Well, probably not too much different from the way I am now. But I remember the violence. You could get so close to the game that literally if a play spilled too far across the sideline, you could be right in the play getting bowled over. But it's a completely different perspective than what you get on television. But you play the game, John. I think now it's a much more violent game than it was then. But aside from that, all of the stuff surrounding the game today, I think, is so much different than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. The militarism combined with it, the nationalism, the bread and circuses distraction.
Right.
And of course, you get television. I mean, this is literally diverting people's attention from what they need to spend time on. So the hoopla surrounding the Super Bowl, every Super Bowl in my building, John, they throw a Super Bowl party. They make a big deal out of it. They ask if you want to come kick in $5 to pay for the food and drink. I have never once attended because I absolutely want nothing to do with it. I'll be happy to get together for some camaraderie with my resident friends in the building and people I don't know. But don't couch it around a football game I have no interest in, and all the symbolism it stands for that I oppose.
Well, yes, I did play, and I did play professional, and I was even a star. And but I didn't play for long. I was. It's ultimately a cult of organized violence. And when you're a young man, I mean, I left it early. I played professional and was a starter as a cornerback before I was finished college, and you know, chosen as the outstanding player of games and such. So I really had a good, but I could not, by the time, and this of course has played out much longer in most people's lives. You know what the average life expectancy of an NFL or a CFL football player is?
Oh, it's pretty small.
53 years of age.
Oh my God.
53 years of age, and a lot of the guys I played with, most of them are dead now. I guess almost all of them are dead now, but I remember them dying off early. But I got out when, you know, I was only 22 when I walked, and I'm still suspended. My nightmare is going back into it again, a success nightmare that I'm called back. And I could not drive my car to the stadium because I just had my shoulder dislocated in a game. And they wanted me, a dislocated shoulder means it's ripped right out of its socket. It's a horrible injury. You may never recover from it. It's a horrible, horrible, painful injury. And they wanted me back. And I was very thrilled as a young guy. I just thought, imagine that they want me back that badly. And they got me back. They got me back within 8 days. And the doctor, I said, well, what about, you know, and he said, well, we're setting up a special harness for you where we chain your arm to your side, your elbow to your side, and it can't dislocate again because basically you're wearing like a straitjacket with this chain holding thick lacings that held your arm into your side. So I couldn't drive my car to the stadium. It was so painful, but I played. With that, and then I also had to have Novocaine shot into my hip and into my right shoulder, and I played, and I played very well. I was amazed because you get so into it at the game, because it is, you know, it's a war game. It's a war sport. Like, the Olympics were all founded on war sports. I don't know whether people know that. And the football is the North American war sport. And it's a very, very military discipline, and there are casualties, as the language uses. There are casualties, lots of casualties, so much so that, as they say, the age expectancy is 53 years of age, and of course, the amount of head blows that you get and concussions that make you into a vegetable, but also knee injuries in the tens of thousands that are like permanent knee injury. It just goes on and on because it is a war sport. It is the Americans' national identity. And after I stopped, I wrote about it because I was a writer, and I said, violence is the very point of football. It's not just an externality or an effect that people would rather rule out. It is the very point of the game. It is structured for violence, and it is structured for harm to the body, and that's what people get off on. And what people used to come to their feet most on was when I would run over someone as a running back, or when I would, you know, put someone in the air that they turned upside down, or, you know, one of these dramatic explosive hits. That was what everybody loved most of all. And that's what they do, you know. It is a property-seizing game. It's rule-governed violence to seize territory as fast and as far as you can get and run it up as far as you can go, and there's no limit. That's the inner logic of the American empire, and that's the inner logic of football. So I wrote about this, and it actually went all over the world, and including in the U.S. It was in the L.A. Times and the Boston Globe, the argument that I was using, because it was very interesting, especially from a player. And it was in China. It was all over the place. What I noticed happening, thinking, well, you know, I'm going to turn the corner here. You know, you're always writing. You hope for a good influence. What I think the influence, ultimate influence was, because I also wrote about players being like slaves. They didn't have any market power of where they chose to play and so forth. Well, what ended up from those initiatives was players became billionaires. because the American Senate actually connected with me saying what to do, and at that age I was pretty young. I said, well, just, you know, just let the rules of the market apply and give the players freedom to negotiate. So that happened, but the bigger thing was, I thought, because I wrote more on the violence built into, you know, it's a sick society's projection of itself into public spectacle, and it's a rule-governed violence for seizing territory. It has military disciplines and terminology throughout. It is a war sport, etc. The influence of it was that the very violence that I was pointing out that people didn't want to talk about became the sales point for the game. So all I did was give them a commercial value of, now we'll get more people wanting to watch it. And so this is, you know, so it was part of the whole trend that we found happening in all the mass media, where it's just violence entertainment. And that's, I'm afraid, what happens in a pathological system, is violence becomes the central entertainment of the pathological as a safety valve or as a distraction. And most of all, it's a distraction. What it's most of all a distraction from is the real struggles underneath, the real life and death struggles that we've been talking about throughout this program and other programs, the real life and death struggles, the real thing that matters, that our life support systems are not destroyed, and that people get enough for their life capacities not to be destroyed, and so that they can lead actual human lives. All that is actually at war with a system which is seeking to destroy it all, anything that we've gained. What the violent spectacle does is divert our attention from what's actually going on inside our lives, the real life and death contests that are going on, onto this spectacle. It just reinforces it as a propaganda. It's always, I mean, the leaders, everybody thinks in terms of being athletes themselves. They all want to be athletes, these people in power, who weren't once, but sometimes they are. But usually they just want to be athletes who are never very good. And they live this game of violence and territorial seizure and strategic planning. I mean, strategic planning is huge. And the military exactness of where your positions are and the speeds and velocity, you know, it's just very, very exact military assault system. Well, when I exposed that, the influence, much to my chagrin, the influence, I would say, was the opposite of what I had intended. It just gave them the major marketing issue for them was that it is violent. And, you know, that's what they show, is just how violent it is and how badly people get hurt. It's all about, you notice, it's all about trades. It's all about who's hurt and who's injured. And it's all about blowing other people out of the stadium. And, you know, but instead of that being a deficit of the game or a problem with the game, that became its essential marketing ploy.
John, I think it sells violence, and it also influences the culture. I've written several times about America's culture of violence, and you can see it in games like football, so violent, especially today with the size and speed and power of the players.
20,000 pounds per square inch of impact loading.
Oh, I mean, somebody like me, if I ever got hit once by any of those guys, I mean, they would literally kill me. They literally would kill me.
I would say that when I, you know, you're right about getting down close in, that if I, you know, you put a normal fit citizen into that game, they would be killed in a play or two. Yeah.
But I think it acclimates young people, especially gets them ready to maybe accept the idea that societies can be violent. America can go to war,
yeah,
and it's okay.
Well,
you know,
take orders is the big one. You know, it's a very, very, you know, obey to consume, obey to get paid, obey to be a hero. The absolute military obedience that is required of people is really quite amazing. And that, of course, is another military aspect of it. So really, it does condition people into acceptance of the system and idealizes the system through this metaphor, as it were, this this paradigm example of the system as a distraction.
John,
it glorifies the system and its sponsors.
Oh, it absolutely
and
does.
They
and
sell
it, and
lots.
It's
a
very,
huge marketing site. It's the biggest marketing site in North America. And the Olympics, of course, is the same thing on another level as
well,
a global marketing site.
Well, of course, the Olympics, I don't think it's supposed to be violent. I mean, very, very fast.
Yeah.
Maybe hockey would
yeah,
be a
well,
violent
true.
Sport.
And I mean, that's interesting because hockey's gotten violent, very violent. That's the gain, the sales cachet. That's the marketing cachet that is violent. That's what you watch for. And then hockey, of course, they encourage fights and so forth because that's part of what draws the audience.
Oh, indeed.
But
they
you'll find
them.
In the Olympics, that's
they
one thing they kind of, it doesn't work so well. I've also played, competitive hockey. And when you play on an Olympic style rink, it's much bigger. It's much bigger. It's like hugely bigger. And you have to be a good skater. You have to be able to fly out there. And you even behind the nets, there's enough space to play a game. I mean, it's really a much bigger rink. And so it selects for skills rather than brutal power. By the way, the American field is 60% smaller than the Canadian field when you do all the, only 60% the size of the Canadian field. NFL and All-Americans and so forth, they got on that larger field, and the same things is happening in Olympic hockey. They get on that wider playing surface, and they can't function. They're used to functioning in close and just brute power, but you can't. It's just too wide open.
John,
and,
the point I really want to stress is selling violence, and it's sold to kids. Movies are violent. Television is violent. You get violent video games. You read violent stories in newspapers. America is a rape culture. I mean, America is literally permeated with violence, and then you supplement it with violent sports like football, and war. War is almost an extension of football for real.
I argued that it was a social paradigm. And it was the paradigm into which people were conditioned and taught to glorify the nature of it, which is rule, govern, violence, to seize as much for yourself with a limit as possible and destroy the opposition, and romanticized and glorified and even transported into the political sphere where the language of this paradigm is used to talk about what you're going to do when you're going to bomb a people. And notice what they show when they're at that Super Bowl. They have the bombers flying overhead. Saying,
exactly.
In case you missed the connection, friends, this is what it is. And everybody's saluting for the bombers, and now you go from the bombs in the air to the bombs on the field, and we show it at peak hour, and we show the bombing at peak hour. They're linked in. They're interlocked.
And you couch it in the national anthem and a giant American flag, and
and
everything is all right in the world.
In air. I mean, you know, it's right into the national anthem. And the only collective interest America has, and this is the greatest of all tragedies, because it really had collective interest.
We're just about over, John.
But not in the Constitution. And so, I guess I should leave it there, Steve.
Yeah, we're out of time. The hour goes by so fast. It was a great hour, John. I really appreciate you coming on. I look forward to getting you back again. Oh, my goodness. I mean, this stuff just makes my stomach churn. John, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Steve.